Juno Afternoon is made possible with support from Sentinel Coffee, serving Southeast with locally roasted organic coffee and door-to-door delivery. More at sentinelcoffee.com. Our next guests are here to take a look at the current state of the Alaska Marine Highway System. Here in Studio A, we have Coast Alaska Regional News Director Jacob Resnick, who broke a story earlier this week about the end of ferry service to Prince Rupert, and Robert Venables. He's the chair of the state's Marine Transportation Advisory Board and executive director of the Southeast Conference. Welcome to the show, both of you.
Hi.
Hi.
Good to be here.
It's nice to have you here. Robert Venables, yesterday in Claire Strempel's story out of KHNS in Haines, she said you pulled double duty as the system's head cheerleader and a critic advocating reform. Is that a fair description?
Well, that sure encompasses a broad scope of really, I think that is fairly accurate. I think that over the years, I've been probably chief cheerleader for at least 30 years. And I think as the years have grown, we've seen a need for reform and the changes over the decades. And so there has been some constructive criticism, I hope, advocating for that reform.
What's a day in the life of Robert Venables like?
Well, you don't have that much time. It's not, it's just an afternoon show, not an all-day show, right?
Right.
But, I think at Southeast Conference right now, we're gearing up for our annual meeting when we'll gather, talk about this very topic and many, many more. So the Marine Highway System has always been a very, very key and topic that's near and dear to our hearts at Southeast Conference and the entire region.
All right. And Jacob Resnick is in the studio as well. Your story earlier this week about ending service to Prince Rupert.
That's right.
A main stop here in Southeast Alaska by British Columbia. Tell us about what brought that story to your attention.
Well, this first came to light in, I think it was in the spring, in May. There is a federal mandate from the U.S. customs agents who operate in the Prince Rupert terminal. Now, Canadian border guards are not armed. American border guards are, but they are not allowed to carry their service weapons in foreign soil in Canada. So they had made a request that they were no longer comfortable checking vehicles and passengers in the Prince Rupert terminal because they argue, because you can legally have a shotgun or a hunting rifle, the public's armed, but they're not, and they didn't feel secure. So they asked the Marine Highway System to do something about that. Marine Highway System looked into contracting with Canadian law enforcement to stand by because they're the only ones who are authorized to be armed in the country and didn't find it feasible. And the clock has run out. And so now we're told that because the state can't satisfy this federal mandate, they're going to shut the pre-clearance site down in the terminal and effectively end service to Prince Rupert, which is – many people understand is like one of the main connections to the North American road system for the state of Alaska.
What would you add about the importance of Prince Rupert?
It's a very strategic point for Southeast Alaska. We have our fishing fleet and producers. They use that link to export fish during the summertime. We've been growing some market for actually wood pellets coming into the market for Southeast Alaska. There's some of the shippers that use that as well. Alaska Marine Lines and others use that link. And the folks in Ketchikan feel like that's a strategic point that commerce could be developed on if only we can get that sense of reliability that could be between those two communities.
Okay. Maybe we can come back to that in a minute. The winter ferry schedule came out yesterday. Is that right, gentlemen?
Yeah. It did.
Okay. And there are some big service changes to Prince William Sound in particular. Before we get to those details, can you take us back to the beginning, Robert Venables, and sort of talk a little bit about Southeast Conference and the inception of the highway?
Well, to go way, way back, this is pre-statehood. So we're talking, a while back. The very beginnings of marine transportation, in this region really was in Haines with Steve Homer and others starting a small vessel freight company between, Juneau, but it was actually more the Cascade Point area, and Haines. And so that was kind of the beginnings. It's come statehood. The state saw the need for connectivity and commerce and transportation. And I think one of the things that folks really do forget is that the beginnings of the Marine Highway System as a state entity was something that the entire state supported through a bond vote to construct the first vessels. And so I think, you know, people that often point to the system as critics without constructive purposes, you know, would say, well, that's, we don't have anything to do with that. That's just something that's Southeast or Prince William Sound or out the chain. But no, it is. You know, we've seen through our studies that over 40% of the summer ridership goes into the rail belt to see Denali and spend funds along the road system there. So it's very much a very key part of the transportation system of the state. And we saw it really heavily utilized in the 60s and 70s. You know, things do change. You know, the reliability and dependability of the air carriers, you know, with instrumentation that's emerged in the last decade or so, there's changes. And so we know that change has to happen. You know, one of the things, though, that was kind of unfortunate is that, you know, we saw as time went by, the systems management become more and more politicized. In the early years, it really did lean more on naval architects and marine engineers. There was, a closer working relationship between the rank and file workers and, you know, just the system as a whole. And it became more politicized over the last, you know, 20 years. And a lot of those inefficiencies were able to be, you know, overcome, if you would, by just the sheer expenditure of funds. We were flush with funds in the state. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of helped mask some of the underlying problems because as the system, you know, continued to grow infrastructure-wise, they built capacity with more and more vessels while the market was not really growing at that same rate. And so after a period of time went by, we saw that we had this big fleet. The vessels were not standardized at all. We had the high-speed vessels. You know, you know, you got everything from the Latuya to the Fairweather to the Columbia and the Kennecott, and they were all built much differently than those first three, which was the Matanuska, Malaspina, and the Taku. And, you know, without that, it just kind of added to the complexities and the expense of the system to this perfect storm that we're at now, where too many vessels not running near capacity to places that, you know, we're not fully utilizing them. At the same time, you're having more capacity and worse weather for airfare, flights and whatnot. So we have to make changes. And I think that's what Southeast Conference has been working with statewide stakeholders on these last 3.5 years to really take a look at saying, okay, so what are some of the changes that should happen to make this a more modernized, efficient system that you know, could really be better responsive and meet the needs in coastal Alaska.
Okay. Can we fast forward to now? A lot has been going on this year, and it may be hard to sort of encapsulate all of that. But where are we now with the ferry system?
You know, right now we have a new administration that came in on the heels of a lot of our work. They commissioned a study that has another independent group taking a look at their recommendations. Our information flow is, you know, some of the work that they're looking at as they form their recommendations. We won't see that work for another few weeks. It's due to DOT in the middle of October. So while that's next month, we don't know how fast that'll get out to the public per se. But I think that once we see that work and those recommendations, that's when the policymakers will start embracing those options. And that's when we'll have an opportunity as stakeholders and communities to vet some of those findings, challenge some of those findings, and maybe morph them into, you know, whatever new paradigm the Marine Highway System takes.
Got it. If someone were to go to the website right now and look at the winter schedule, what changes might they see?
In Southeast, it's not much different, I think, than last year. I haven't done a deep dive, but I have done a quick look, and I see, you know, February being a very, very hard year, a hard month for a number of our villages, Angoon and Cake in particular, with zero service. Lynn Canal, I see just like once a week during the month of February. The rest of the months, you know, it looks like basic service needs are being met. But that's Southeast. You go over to Prince William Sound, I can't find a ferry moving in the region.
6 months, they'll be cut off. As October 1, I don't think they get another ferry until May.
And that's when the summer schedule is supposed to kick in. So that's the entire winter for them, and that is really devastating to their economy.
From one of the listening sessions, I have a quote here from Becky Chapek. She runs a rental business company, car rental business in Cordova. Quote, "This total lack of service is not just an inconvenience," Chapek said. It is a harsh, unwarranted action that will put the nails in the coffin of many businesses here who are struggling to make it through the winter months. Do you guys – is that true? Does that seem true to you?
Well, if they end up with zero service and zero business, I would say the revenue could probably be somewhere close to zero if that's what they're depending on. Yeah. That sounds devastating for, you know, keeping your lights on and your employees paid. I don't know that it's the end of the story. I've not had opportunity to talk to anybody at Marine Highway Systems, you know, since the schedule came out and even since the Marine Transportation Advisory Board meeting that we had. We raised the question, you know, what is there something that can be done cooperatively between the unions and the administration that might be able to deploy these vessels a little bit differently? You know, both the Leconte and the Aurora, you know, have crews on there. They also have the galleys with the food service. You know, are there things that we could do to structure that so maybe the crews are only working, you know, one crew, 4 days on, 3 days off? You know, is there opportunity to maybe not have food service on board? You know, the folks in Cordova would much rather have the transportation service and not the hamburgers, pack a lunch. And, you know, these things, you know, sound simple on the surface, but there are complicated union contracts and agreements. So it's going to take a cooperative effort. But at our meeting, they all said they would be willing to sit down and talk about that. So I'm hopeful that this is not the end for many of those communities this summer, this winter.
I just want to add one of the other factors is, you know, we got these two brand new Alaska class ferries, and one of them came online in May. But they've taken them back offline because they needed alterations to the way that they load and unload. So they were built, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, for Lynn Canal, and one of them was supposed to be deployed for Prince William because they still haven't – the second one still hasn't come on board. That's not available for the Prince William Sound runs, and that's another factor why the winter schedule is so devastating for that area.
And another factor why we continue to feel like there needs to be a governance change, you know, for how things are done. You know, those two new ferries, beautiful ships, but it took five governors to get it created. And that's a very politicized, inefficient methodology for designing and constructing anything, let alone a boat.
They also decided to forsake any federal funds to build it. So it was hugely expensive to the state of Alaska. And the other wrinkle there is we haven't seen this report, but there's whispers of divestment or, you know, privatization, things like that. Those vessels, from my understanding, don't have the same restrictions and requirements should they want to surplus them and sell them. Like, you can't just sell a ferry that was built with federal dollars because then you have to pay back the feds. Those brand new shiny vessels don't have those same restrictions, and that makes people very nervous what their near future could be.
If you're just tuning in to Juneau Afternoon, we're talking about the state of the Alaska Marine Highway System with Jacob Bresnik and Robert Venables. The winter schedule just came out tomorrow, and there is no service to Prince William Sound, Cordova and Valdez included. And correct me if I'm wrong, Robert, there might still be hope for a workaround this winter?
I don't want to offer hope. I want to offer a commitment to keep working toward that.
Okay.
I'm not sure if it's hopeful or not, but, you know, we did have an expression of willingness from, you know, two of the unions and AMHS to at least have the conversation. So, you know, we're going to push forward toward that to see what we can get out of there, because I don't really feel like that's acceptable to a community like Cordova to have zero service for 6 months.
If you go to KTOO.org, we have stories from Jacob Bresnik and other reporters from the Alaska Public Radio Network on our webpage to get more details on all of this. I want to thank both you guys for coming on the show today and letting us know more about the ferries. Is there anything I'm missing, anything you'd like to add?
I just think one thing we're watching is this shutdown of service to British Columbia, to Prince Rupert. We're still trying to get more details about why the talks really did collapse between the state of Alaska and the federal agency, Customs and Border Protection. We'd heard whispers that actually there were some working proposals being discussed, but that they were too expensive. I got a statement from DOT this afternoon saying that they had some verbal conversations that they could possibly get Royal Canadian Mounted Police to stand by at the terminal and guard the American Guards to their satisfaction, for the federal mandate. But it was going to be very expensive, about $250,000 to do so by bringing in some RCMP from a different detachment. And at this point in time, the state wasn't willing to do that. I do know that the mayor of Prince Rupert is going to be traveling to Alaska to have some talks with the governor's office. So there's work going on to try to resolve this because communities in Southeast Alaska and communities on that side of the border don't find this acceptable.
If you had to guess, Jacob, will there be stops in Prince Rupert this winter?
Not next month. I think that they've already wound things down and CBP is pulling out now. So we're hoping people who use the fair are hoping – myself, I don't mind saying I'm hoping that these kinds of disruptions will only be temporary.
Jacob Resnick, Robert Venables, thank you both for coming on today's show.
Thank you.
Steamer. I am just content to be a dreamer. Even if I could afford a steamer, I will take the ferry boat every time.